Welcome to your Healthcare Choice of Chance. I'm Ellen Kagan, and I'm so happy today to have with me as a guest Kathleen Clark, an attorney out in San Francisco, who will talk to us about collaborative practices, a new field which brings compassion and patient safety to situations where there are medical errors. It's a whole new field. I'm sure you're not familiar with it. We're going to talk about it for half an hour. But I'm so pleased that she's here because I think this is an issue we all want to be informed about. And to give you a little background of Kathleen, who is on the phone with me from the beautiful city of San Francisco where I used to live, which I love, here is something about Kathleen. Very impressive. Kathleen Clark has practiced law and mediation for 23 years. She received her PhD from Tilburg University in 2008 with a dissertation topic of bringing dialogue and collaborative law to healthcare. She is founder and CEO of Servant Lawyership and is a California State Bar-approved MCLE provider. Kathy has published articles on collaborative and other non-adversarial practices, disclosure, dialogue, alternative dispute resolution, the transformational settlement in the James Woods medical malpractice case, and Appreciative Inquiry, all of which have been published in American Bar Association journals and in the Daily Journal, California's legal newspaper. Kathleen is currently writing a book on these topics, tentatively entitled Bringing Healing to Law and Medicine. Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing very well.
Oh, I'm so glad, and I'm so glad you're here with me. This collaborative law, I mean, it's absolutely collaborative practices. I find it so completely fascinating. And first of all, I'd like you to just explain to the audience, what is it exactly?
Collaborative law is a structured, voluntary, non-adversarial dispute resolution practice. And it originated in family law about 20 years ago, and it's been traditionally used in family law. So rather than, of course, the traditional adversarial process of going to winding up in trial and settlement conferences and, you know, taking a long period of time and basically spending a lot of the family's resources on attorneys, this collaborative process was instituted. And the process involves bringing the parties and their attorneys together to resolve disputes. And so the process has been expanded into other areas of the law outside of the family law framework. And it's such an ideal fit in a medical error situation because it can be called into play immediately once there's any thought that there's been a medical error. And if the parties are trained, a whole process of apology, compensation, explanation of error, that sort of thing, can take place very quickly. So, and I use the term collaborative law and collaborative practices very distinctly because collaborative law has a lot of requirements like written agreements and that sort of thing that, you know, I won't go into too much. We have limited time, but collaborative practices are sort of using an array of different practices that may not involve written agreements. It may just involve people sitting down together with their attorneys after medical error and having open conversations without any kind of written agreement. So there are a lot of different practices that can be part of, you know, part of the resolution.
Right, right. You know, I find this collaborative practice is so fascinating because I don't know if you read my book, Ellen in Medical Land.
Uh-huh.
True stories of how I fell down medicine's black hole and still lived after all, which is on Kindle. Because I had a horrible experience. In one of my chapters, you'll read Medical Care from Hell, where I really, I mean, it's lucky I didn't die, and I never got an apology. All they had to do was sit me down, as you're talking about in a collaborative practice, and say, Ellen, what happened to you? We're so sorry. That's all they had to do. But instead what they did was treat me as though I was the person, the victim was the person who brought this on herself, which is a horrible thing to do to anybody. So what you're doing, I think, is absolutely fantastic. How did you get into this? What turned you on to collaborative practices?
Well, I got into this because in my legal career, I was, you know, a traditional litigator for many years and was never happy with sort of being in that role of going to battle every day.
Right.
And a friend of mine, my dearest friend that I went to grade school with in New Jersey, who lives in this area, lost her son to medical error in 2003.
And how old was he, Kathleen?
He was 21.
Ah, horrible.
And what happened in that situation is the family, you know, I gave them the name of a traditional medical malpractice lawyer, and they contacted him and were working with him. And at the same time, I advised my friend that, you know, if you want to sit down with the hospital and the physicians and find out exactly what happened to Eric and get your questions answered and have some kind of face-to-face exchange with the people in the hospital, you tell your attorney that's what you want, and your attorney will probably tell you that why that can't be done, or, you know, it would be difficult or too expensive or various reasons why it couldn't happen.
Doesn't this, when you're dealing with an attorney, I think, which is why so many people don't want to, it just escalates the argument. I mean, it gets you angrier and angrier. Isn't that really what happens when you have an attorney in a situation like this?
Yes. And
there's no healing in this process. It's just, you just get angrier and angrier.
So what? So I suggested to my friend that she just, your attorney will probably tell you why it can't be done or isn't feasible, and you just keep saying, this is what I want. And it doesn't mean you're going to get it, but you are speaking up for yourself. And eventually she was in a whole sort of litigation process going in one direction, and I, on behalf of the family, wrote a letter to someone I know in that healthcare system and said...
How many letters did that take, though? Because I remember reading about this. It took you many times, didn't it, before you...
It took 3 letters over a period of about 2 years.
And what changed it? I mean, first you had no response, and then suddenly you had a response.
Yes. And so what happened is, in the interim, before I got a response, the litigation had settled. So that piece of the process was over and done with. So this healthcare organization came to meetings with my friend and responded to my letter, and basically started sitting down and meeting with her and explaining what happened and listening to her and working with her to improve health care for all, which of course was one of her main concerns about, you know, if nobody else knows about this, if this isn't public information, then how is it going to be prevented for someone else? So anyway, she started working with that system and had several meetings with them and spoke to a group of their physicians and told the story of her son and what happened to him. And this system created a lot of improvements as a result of these conversations that my friend had with them. Because, you know, she sat in a hospital room with her son day after day after day, witnessing his care, witnessing other physicians, standing at his bedside, talking about him. You know, she witnessed all these various processes.
Did she see mistakes being made? Were the questions in her mind as her son got sicker and sicker, or she really just didn't know?
No, she didn't see any mistakes being made. Mm. But I'll give you an example of one thing that happened. Is she, the morning that her son died, they called, the facility called her at 4 o'clock in the morning and said, your son's heart is failing down here. And she and her other son and brother-in-law ran down to this facility, and the facility has a metal detector. And so they were delayed, basically, in getting in to see their
Terrible.
Son because of the metal detector.
Right.
And the security guard didn't know who they were and why they were there in the middle of the night, and they didn't want emergency care. It just involved a lot of wasted time.
Yep.
With them waiting, well, the security guard made all these phone calls to find out whether it was appropriate to let them in, etc.
She must have been off the walls.
You know, that's something that she was able to point out. I mean, that's a little thing, but in that situation, it was not a little thing, of course.
You know what I find very interesting in all this is that getting a financial settlement doesn't ease your pain. It really doesn't. I have a friend who lost his child needlessly at Children's Hospital here in Boston. And, of course, he received a lot of money. He did not, in a settlement, in a civil suit. But his pain is there every single day because he did not go through collaborative practices at all. So I think that's something to bear in mind when people, politicians or whatever say, oh, they're just, you know, patients are just looking for money when something terrible happens. That is not true.
Yes, you know, everything I've read, is starting back with my dissertation research and forward to today, suggests that, you know, all kinds of studies make it clear that really patients, money is sort of not ever the top of the rung.
Never.
Trying to prevent this from happening to someone else, and mostly they just want answers.
And also you want to be to recognize that the institution or the doctors made a mistake and to apologize.
Yes.
I mean, that did not happen for me, and the upshot, and the president of the hospital was involved also, and the upshot, he was forced to resign this past year on a sex scandal, which, as you can imagine, Kathleen, was the happiest day of my life, really. Everyone kept saying, Ellen, you know, the old boy network here in Boston, he's never going to lose his job. Well, he did. After 5 years, 4.5 years from when this happened to me, he did lose his job.
CEO of Children's Hospital?
No, this was, I'm not going to mention the hospital, but it was a Harvard teaching hospital.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
And no one, when this happened to me, basically I was told I was going to die, and there was absolutely nothing wrong with me. Told over the phone by a nurse practitioner that my days were numbered. Nothing wrong with me, Kathleen, at all. And never an apology. Never. In fact, I was told by the quality assurance doctor at the hospital, because I made a lot of noise, as you can imagine, that, do you know, Ellen, how much your oncologist suffered when she thought you were going to die? She suffered, Kathleen. Of course, I didn't. I mean, what's it to me to lose my life, right? But now we have to worry about the doctors who are losing their patients. So the whole thing was really horrible and very unsettling, and it took me a long time to get over it. But what I want to get back to is collaborative practices is who participates in something like this, and how do you get it going? How do you get the whole process going?
Okay, well, who participates in this are the parties, basically. So it would be the injured patient or the patient's family. And on the defense side, of course, it would be whatever physicians, nurses, hospital administration are involved in the action. So it would be the parties. I mean, I hate to use that term.
I know, but...
Yeah, okay. So we understand who we're talking about.
Right.
And their attorneys.
Right.
So it might be an attorney for the patient, and then on the defense side, it would probably be one for the hospital, one for the physician. You know, they'd have their own individual attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to get the process started is, first of all, familiarity with the process and training in it, you know, professional development, such that when something happens, you know which attorneys to call on.
Yep.
Know how to get the process started.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily something that can only be started by the patient. A physician who is familiar with this process can call up an attorney or work with the hospital attorney, however it all shakes out,
right?
And say that they want to start a collaborative process.
Mm-hmm. Now let me ask you, sir.
Because the sooner, as you know from your own experience, the sooner you bring together a healing sensibility with these various parties and their attorneys, the more likely you are to settle. And and further down the road with that is, even if that process doesn't come to a settlement, the parties and the attorneys have had the opportunity to sit down and respond to each other face to face, and you get to see other people's humanity.
Right.
So even if you have to go into a litigation process to get what you want, you know, fair damages, you never look at those people the same as when you walk in, as when you start with the litigation process without anything beforehand. Then you're, you know, then it's acrimonious and people are angry and agitated, and, you know, it becomes this long nightmare of just general unpleasantness, sleepless nights, etc. But if you start with this kind of a process and then have to go to litigation, people just don't see each other in that kind of framework because you've all worked really hard to resolve the case and it didn't work. But you still see each other as caring people.
Right.
So you have the opportunity to sit down across from a physician who says, you know, I really am sorry that this happened. No matter how they phrase it, you know, you see them as people.
So. Right. You must remember the movie The Verdict with Paul Newman. Did you ever see that?
Oh, God, one of my all-time favorites.
Absolutely, because so much of that is still happening, and if we had collaborative practices, back then, certainly the story would have been very different, but it's a wonderful movie. It's a wonderful movie. Let's talk a bit about James Woods and what happened there, because I think it's very instructive. Oh, no, before we get into James, I'd like you to give your website out in case people want to read more about what you're doing.
Okay, my website is www.servantlawyership.com. I'll just spell it out.
Okay.
S-E-R-V-A-N-T-L-A-W-Y-E-R-S-H-I-P.
And it's going to be in the credits, folks, so if you missed it, it'll be right there. And if you're listening on podcast, of course, obviously you heard it. But let's get to, was there any, you know, I did also put up in the credits where your article is, so it's another place for them to go.
Yes, and all my articles are on my website.
Okay. I know, before we get into James Woods, are there many of these collaborative practices people out here in Massachusetts? Is it throughout the United States, or is it basically just in the Bay Area at this point?
Oh, actually, it's sort of growing in different regions around the country. You know, there are many hospitals that take part in, like, open disclosure processes and are willing to talk, say, to the press and have articles in the newspaper about what they're trying to do and about when something goes wrong.
Right.
But they're limited, but they're growing, like the University of Illinois and the University of Michigan Health Centers both have very large programs in this kind of disclosure. And also, a lot of the Harvard-associated hospitals have the process as well. Although, you know, you always hear stories in it about a case where it doesn't work or it's just, you know, doesn't even happen. It doesn't appear to be an option. But in general, there are lots of facilities that have this kind of process and this kind of collaborative thinking already in place.
Mm-hmm.
There's a line between facilities that take part in these kind of practices, and then there are other facilities that still feel like, you know, if you apologize and if you sit down with people and talk about the situation and the fact that there was an error, you're more likely to be sued.
Yes.
Probably you're less likely to be sued.
Yeah. You know, when this happened to me at this Harvard teaching hospital where I was told I was going to die, and there was absolutely nothing wrong with me, Kathleen. Nothing.
Oh yeah.
I was had as much energy then as I do now. I mean, it was really pathetic. But at that time, there was an article in the Boston Globe saying how Harvard teaching hospitals were now saying that apologies made a big difference and people did not sue. And this was when they did not apologize to me. I couldn't believe the hypocrisy of that.
Yeah.
You know, this was actually in the Globe. When this whole thing was happening to me, they were saying how Harvard Medical School and the Harvard teaching hospitals did believe you should apologize. No one apologized to me at this particular Harvard teaching hospital ever, Kathleen. So that it's very interesting how they'll say one thing and do another, I find.
Well, I'll tell you that that's very interesting that you're mentioning that, because what happened in my friend's case is somewhere along the way, about probably 2 years into 2 years after her son died, there was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle about apology after medical error, and they quoted the CEO of this particular healthcare system, and he talked about, you know, this is what we're doing now, and we meet with the patients, and my friend and I, of course, saw this and were so appalled, because that's what we'd been asking for and getting response. So what I did was write a letter to this CEO and quote his language
right.
article, and what I said was, you know, I'm sure you're doing this with the best of intentions, and I really applaud you. However, this new policy hasn't helped my friend, because she's still out there waiting to hear from someone, requesting that someone call her. And that's the letter they responded to.
Right. Well, what is a riot is the CEO who was forced to resign at this Harvard teaching hospital, who absolutely would not apologize to me and was hiding everything that happened to me. This is what he wants to be now. He is now a patient advocate. And I laugh. I think he believes in transparency. And I, you know, Kathleen, I just laugh and laugh because it's so hypocritical, really. But this is what happens, and you have. I think the bottom line here too is you must stick up for yourself. You must just keep fighting, as you did with your friend, and grab the attention. Just tell them, this is what I need, and this is what you must do for me. And with that, I want to get into James Woods, because that is such a heartbreaking story. Would you talk to the audience about what happened to him at the Kent Hospital here in I think it's Warwick, Rhode Island?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And I'll just tell you one other thing before I talk about Woods, and that is I think what is so important in the whole process of trying to reach out, for instance, in my friend's case after the article in the newspaper, is caution in the language you use.
Yes, absolutely right.
If you write in the letter like a traditional lawyer, then you're not going to really get anywhere, is my experience.
Right.
But if you talk about, this would be healing for everyone,
mm-hmm.
and that's what this process should be about, just like healthcare, then you probably will get a different response.
Right.
Anyway,
I just want to interrupt one thing and emphasize. When you have something happen to you, you lose a child, like your friend lost her child,
mm-hmm.
And I have a friend who lost his child at Children's Hospital. The devastation, there are no words for it. There really aren't, are what the Woods family went through. I mean, we can talk about it till kingdom comes, Kathleen, but how you feel forever, the pain is so horrible that for a hospital or the medical establishment to ignore that, it just adds to the pain. It added to my pain when I went through this horrible situation, told I was going to die when I wasn't. So, and made to feel like I was the one that brought it on myself. It's a terrible, terrible thing to do to anybody. It really, truly is. It's heartless, is what it is. So let's talk now about James Woods, because I think he and his family are to be applauded and are truly wonderful.
Oh, what happened in his case, I mean, I came into it, sort of down the road, but
mm-hmm.
what happened in his case is his brother died at Kent Hospital in Rhode Island in 2006. And his brother went to the emergency room and was having chest pain.
And he was not a well kid anyway, was he? I thought he had some problems anyhow.
Didn't oh, his brother?
Yes, I thought his
brother. I think he had a history of some problems. But in any case, he went to the emergency room because...
Oh, no, the reason I bring that up is that the family knew that he had problems and were very vigilant about it.
Yeah.
I think that was the thing. When they went with him, they kind of knew. They knew that this guy had problems. So that they were just watching everything as his care unfolded. Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to bring that out.
So his James Woods brother, whose name was Michael, died in the emergency room, and the Woods family, basically from the very beginning, just wanted to sit down with the hospital.
But weren't they asking for something to be done to him, and it wasn't done?
Yeah.
Checking his heart or something, and they weren't doing that?
Yeah. They asked for a heart monitor, and it wasn't done.
Yeah. And then he had a heart attack. During this whole process.
Well, he died, basically.
Yeah.
What the family wanted and what James Woods told his attorney from the beginning is they wanted to have a conversation with the hospital. They wanted to understand what happened. They wanted to understand how the hospital was going to improve their practices, all the things that basically all patients want and all patients' families, and no one would speak to them. So they went forward with litigation because they really felt like they didn't have any choice.
And they wanted to get money, I think a settlement for his daughter, one of his children or something?
His underage son.
Son, right.
But in addition to the money, of course, they wanted these other things that they weren't getting. So they went through the entire litigation process, and they were 3 weeks into trial. And the other thing, of course, with James Woods is he was talking about this to the media, and it was in the newspaper every day. And the CEO of the hospital, in the beginning of trial, said to her attorneys, I want to sit down and meet with James Woods. And the attorney said, that can't be done. That just doesn't happen, especially in the middle of trial. And she continued to insist such that in the third week of trial, she asked her attorneys to ask Woods' attorney if they could sit down together and have a meeting. And James Woods' first response was, over my dead body, that's not going to happen. Because by then, everything was so acrimonious.
Right.
sterile and nasty. And, you know, there was such, according to James Woods, who spoke at a conference that I facilitated and put together here, he said there was such a lack of respect.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of accumulated over time.
Like what happened to me. No respect. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people laughing in the corridors.
Yeah.
Sort of no one respecting and paying attention to the family and what the family was going through. So in any case, the CEO of the hospital, his name is Sandy Coletta, arranged this meeting through the attorneys and sat down with Woods and his attorney and came to a settlement that's still confidential, but she apologized and she asked him to be on the board of a new institute that she was setting up to reevaluate and improve patient safety, basically the whole healthcare delivery process in Kent Hospital. And she had $5 million to do that, and she wanted to name it after Michael Woods.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted James Woods to be on the board, and he was so gracious and grateful that she had apologized, that someone had finally seen them and seen the pain of the family, and particularly Woods' mother, of course, who was part of this conversation.
Who was totally devastated. I mean,
that
it almost
mother,
killed her. Yeah, it was a terrible, terrible thing. Kathleen, this is a happy ending to this very sad story. And, of course, everyone knows that James Woods is the actor. So he has access to media, which most of us don't. Dennis Quaid had the same thing with his kids.
Yes.
If you're in the limelight, you can get attention. But most of us can't. Most of us
can't.
Well,
that's exactly. I mean, you know, it's unfortunate that it takes somebody like James Woods or Dennis Quaid to get attention day in and day out paid
right
to these issues, but thank God for them, because
absolutely,
you know, of course you wouldn't wish this kind of horror on anyone, but if it's going to happen to someone who is going to get constant media attention, and this is all then before the public, and this whole healthcare community that used Kent Hospital in Rhode Island saw this tragedy unfold and all this anger day after day after
day. Right. And with that, Kathleen, I hate to interrupt you, but do you know our show is over?
Oh, you're kidding.
And I just loved having you, because I'd love you to come back and we can elaborate on even more things. And
maybe, that would be wonderful.
Yes, because I think what she's talking about, folks, gives us all hope that we can come to some understanding with our medical people. And I think through this process, they see that we're human. We're not trying to hurt them. But we do need respect, Kathleen. We do need understanding, especially when we have a medical adverse event. So thank you so much for getting up early this morning in San Francisco. And I hope Kathleen will come back. Please join me again next month. Good evening.
Thank you.
My pleasure.